Monster Man, episode 454. Snakes.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
In today's episode, we are taking a look at some more monsters from Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. We've got a lot of monsters in today's entries, but they're sort of organized a little oddly. We start with an omnibus entry that includes a wide range of different snakes. So snakes are one of the classic animal monsters. Maybe like snakes and wolves are kind of the two absolutely iconic ones. You know, for all the trash that I talked about wolves in my boars episode, I can't deny that they're kind of the animal that is also a monster. Snakes, wolves, and sharks. They're something that you encounter both in mythology and in pulp adventure stories, so they apply to the different flavors of D&D, and there are so many different kind of magical beliefs about snakes that it, in different cultures throughout history, that they feel appropriate for a fantasy setting as antagonists, right? Like, if you're going into a ruined temple, you sort of feel like you wanted stones to have all these snakes slithering between them. This omnibus entry includes 9 different kinds, and includes both real-world snakes, which are divided into these sort of broad categories like, you know, constrictor and constrictor, giant, and also fantastic snakes like the amphisbaena. You know, I've always wondered how well the amphisbaena, which is a snake with a head at each end, in case you don't remember its appearance from Monster Manual 2, I think? Anyway, I wonder how well the amphisbaena works really as a D&D monster, because it's mainly kind of a signifier that you're in the realm of medieval fantasy. If you look at bestiaries about the amphisbaena, the main point of it isn't really that it's incredibly dangerous, is that it has 2 heads. But then when you include the amphisbaena in a D&D game, I would say that it's not like an incredibly well-known medieval monster. It's not like a monopod or a blemmy or something like that. So you'd have to kind of explain the bit unless you were playing with a table full of medievalists, which, okay, you might be. Speaking of creatures from kind of medieval bestiaries, we also have the jaculi here, or the jaculi, which is the snake that kind of like springs at people. It's not its own entry, however. It's kind of like an idea, a template almost, that you can apply to other existing snake types. And I feel like here we see something almost like an ancestor, although a much less mechanically complicated ancestor, of the template idea that was so important in Monsters in 3rd edition. We also get a wise ancient snake called the Elder Serpent. But I feel like the idea of a wise ancient snake, the idea being that this is just a regular snake, but it's lived so long that it's become intelligent. But the way that D&D treats intelligence is as a scale. And animals are on that scale sort of lower than humans of all kinds. So the Elder Serpent has increased its intelligence through, you know, all the time that it's lived. But what that has given it is the intellect of an extremely stupid person. By human standards, it is pretty dense, having an intelligence of maybe up to 7. And this is not really the wisdom that I was looking for in an ancient serpent, right? When we have stories about the wisdom of serpents, they tend to be about how cunning and deceitful they are, or how they know mystical secrets from some kind of land beyond. But not that they're like, well, it's amazing that this serpent is so smart. It's as smart as a small child. That would be incredibly impressive if you met a serpent that was as bright as a little kid, but in a kind of like dog walking on its hind legs kind of way, right? Is that from Dr. Johnson? Did he say that the remarkable thing about the dog walking on its hind legs is not that it was done well, but that it was done at all? So, you know, a serpent that can talk would be amazing in the real world. But in D&D, where animals can talk all the time, the serpent needs to be notable for what it says. And unfortunately, it's pretty thick, so it probably doesn't say anything all that interesting. So you can just imagine these adventurers leaving some kind of offering, you know, some delicacies for the serpent, and it like slithers out of its little hole, and they go, "Oh, wise serpent, bless us with your ancient knowledge." And the serpent goes, I want mouses. It's a bit of an anticlimax. Just make the ancient serpent smart, cowards. Also, the ancient serpents have titles, which must be given to them by humans because the, or like Yuan Ti or whatever, because they're, well, I would say that the vocabulary in them is probably more complex than these serpents can actually handle with their relatively limited intelligence. Also, Grand Snake Master, it just sounds a little daft. It sounds like what the villain in a kid's cartoon is called in the first draft of the script. Though if the 80s have taught me anything, you know, one of those lessons is that I don't think kids' cartoons really typically got multiple script drafts. One idea that is also included with these discussions of elder serpents is that their shed skins are believed to have magical properties, specifically that they have healing powers. And I really like that idea because that is a belief. Well, not so much that they have healing powers. I'm sure that is true. You know, pretty much everything has been believed to have healing powers at some point in some culture. So it wouldn't surprise me to find out that shed skins have healing powers. But the idea that serpents shedding their skins is like a highly important magical or symbolic act is one that has been relatively widespread in different cultures at different times in history. Serpents were often thought of as symbols of immortality. The one reason they're so often associated with the gods, and that immortality was because they would shed their skins, which is like being reborn, like being rejuvenated. In addition to the regular snakes, we have the snake, winged. Now, why isn't the winged snake part of the previous entry? It's not because it's a fantastical creature, because there are fantastical creatures in the entry. My guess would be because it is a later addition. Remember that when we look at Monsters Manual, we are seeing a compilation of things from the Monsters Compendium, and probably the original Monsters Compendium had this snakes entry, and then some Monsters Compendium supplement added the snake, winged, which is a creature from the Forgotten Realms. They may have originally appeared in a 1992 supplement. I'm not so sure about that. That wouldn't surprise me anyway. The winged snakes are quite different from like a Kuatl, which is another example of a monster that is a winged serpent. They're almost sort of hummingbird-like. They have wings that they flap in a super fast, blurry motion, and they are not typically aggressive unless provoked. They can spit acid venom, and they have a static electricity breath weapon that sets flammable objects on fire, such as, you know, your hair. Fifth edition always has that rule, flammable objects that are not being worn or carried catch fire. Now, that doesn't make any sense. You know, why would something not catch fire just because it was being worn or carried? But it does prevent breath weapons from just destroying all of a party's items, melting down all the gold pieces, you know, blowing up the quest rewards, etc., etc. It kind of reduces that role of inventory management, which I think is something that a lot of people wanted in D&D, right? Is to do less inventory management. However, here that's exactly what it does, and I bet it made those monsters quite unwelcome sights to adventuring parties. There's a lot of very naturalistic stuff in their entry, which I feel fits, because these are basically wildlife. They're just a dangerous animal with, like, the additional role of being a signifier that you're an exotic other kind of place. And you know what? I can see that. Like, I like the idea of the description, you know, the sun is slanting through the canopy and the colorful snakes are flitting from branch to branch. So the snake, winged, it's not necessarily going to set the world on fire. Well, I mean, apart from with its static breath, but it's a nice visual image. I like the idea of using it to kind of establish something about the area where you are. And so, yeah, I feel like this creature works pretty well. It's not necessarily going to be the campaign's main villain, but it's a memorable encounter with a fun visual. So overall, I think it's a worthy addition. All right, that is about all the monsters that we have time for today. In our next episode, well, if you are a $2 or higher Patreon subscriber, you're going to get the first in a series, probably a fairly short series, of Patron Deities episodes in which I'm going to be discussing Tengrism, the religion common in medieval Central Asia. And then at the end of the week, we're going to take a look at some monsters from a classic Japanese tale. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.